We're going to do a study on the life of David, but I thought, well, let's go ahead and expand it a tad and pick up some of the information we have in Scripture about other people in his lives that affected him greatly, like Samuel and Saul. And so we'll go ahead and just do the books of 1 and 2 Samuel. That's kind of just a little bit of an expansion over what we were going to do anyway. And I thought before we jumped into those two books, or started the 1 Samuel here this morning, that I'd try to review for you Israel's history, some of it anyway, that kind of gets us up to this point, sort of resets the stage. And let's pick the history up at the time of the Exodus. We won't go all the way back to Abraham. That's a little too long, but we'll pick it up here at the time of the Exodus. You remember they've been down there in Egypt, in Egyptian bondage for either 250 years or so, or closer to 400, depending on whether it's measured from Abraham or just the time they spent in Egypt. There's some debate about exactly the timing of all of that. But in Exodus, actually chapter 12, God institutes a certain procedure and redeems his people thereby. It's called the Passover. In Exodus chapter 12, he is going to bring his redeemed people out of Egyptian bondage and take them to the promised land. He says in Exodus chapter 12, "Now the Lord said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, 'This month shall be the beginning of months for you. It is to be the first month of the year to you. Speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying, on the 10th of this month, they'd each take a lamb for themselves according to their father's household, a lamb for each household. Now, if the household is too small for a lamb, then he and his neighbor nearest to his house are to take one according to the number of persons in them, according to what each man should eat, you are to divide the lamb. Your lamb shall be unblemished, male, a year old. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats. And you shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month, and the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel is to kill it at twilight." That's about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. When did the Lord die? About 3 o'clock in the afternoon. This Passover lamb, of course, was a foreshadowing of him. "Moreover, they shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the house in which they eat it. Mark your door with the blood of this lamb. And they shall eat the flesh that same night, roasted with fire, and they shall eat it with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. Do not eat any of it raw or boiled at all with water, but rather roasted with fire, both its head, its legs, along with its entrails. And you shall not leave any of it until morning, but whatever is left of it until morning you shall burn with fire. Now you shall eat of it in this manner, with your loins girded, sandals on your feet, staff in your hand, and you shall eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. For I will go through the land of Egypt on that night and strike down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgment. I am the Lord. And the blood shall be a sign for you on the houses where you live. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you, and no plague will befall you to destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt. And this day shall be a memorial to you, and you shall celebrate it as a feast of the Lord throughout your generations. You are to celebrate it as a permanent ordinance." So God redeemed his chosen nation via this, it actually will become a memorial. This was the initial one of it, this Passover, by instructing them that if they would put the blood of this lamb over their doorposts, when the death angel came through there and saw that, he would not slay the firstborn in that household. So if you believed God, you put the blood on, didn't you? And I suppose that if you didn't believe God, you didn't fool with it, and you lost your firstborn. So he initially began his relationship with this redeemed group of people through this act of the Passover. And in Exodus chapter 13, verse 21 and 22, "The Lord was going before them in a pillar of cloud by day to lead them on the way, and a pillar of fire by night to give them light that they might travel by day and by night. He did not take away the pillar of cloud by day nor the pillar of fire by night from before the people." So when God brought them out of Egypt, he showed them via their personal experience that he was going to lead them to where he wanted them to go. There was a cloud in the daytime that marked his presence, and it would go before them and they would follow that cloud. There was a pillar of fire at night that lit up the whole terrain, the whole countryside, and they could travel at night and see where they were going. So he showed them right off the bat that he would lead them. And he did. He brought them out of Egypt down to the Red Sea. And you remember that incident where they He miraculously parted the Red Sea, and they went through there on dry land, all 2 million of them, roughly. I mean, you don't just get through there in a few seconds, do you? It takes a little while to get through that thing. And so he led them through there. He led his people as he said they would. He would. And one would think that that would be kind of a good situation. They would be happy and follow him, and everything would be okay. But in Exodus 15, 22 and following, Moses led Israel from the Red Sea, and he went out into the wilderness of Shur, and they went 3 days in the wilderness, and they found no water. And when they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore it was named Marah, which means bitter. And the people grumbled at Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" That's kind of some cold water thrown on that good start they had there, wasn't it? They started grumbling because they didn't have water to drink. Right off the bat, they're just out of Egypt, just coming down through here, headed down to Sinai, and already we're seeing some unhappy campers. Then he cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree, and he threw it in the waters, and the waters became sweet. There he made for them a statute, a regulation, and there he tested them. And he said to them, in verse 26 of Exodus chapter 15, "If you will give earnest heed to the voice of the Lord your God, and do what is right in his sight, and give ear to his commandments, and keep all his statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you which I have put on the Egyptians, for I, the Lord, am your healer." Notice the condition now of God's blessing on these people. They had to pay attention to what he said. They had to believe his word. They had to obey him. So right off the bat, the relationship between God and his redeemed people is one of they must obey him in order to receive his blessings. And they were griping and complaining there about the water. In chapter 16, we have the problem of food. He took care of the problem of water just before. Now we got food as a problem. They set out from Elam. All the congregation, the sons of Israel, came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elam and Sinai. That's down here, in other words, right in through here. So they've moved on down into this Juneau region. And the whole congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled again against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness, and the sons of Israel said to them, "We would that we had died by the Lord's hand in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat, and when we ate bread to the full. For you brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." Talking about a non-appreciative attitude. "We'd rather be back in Egypt, where we at least could eat, than to come out here into this wilderness and die of starvation, Moses. You bum! You brought us out here." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may test them whether or not they will walk in my instruction." You see, this daily provision thing is to see whether or not they will trust God daily for that provision. They couldn't stash it up. They couldn't go gather up 4 months of it and stash it somewhere and then forget God for 4 months. They had to trust and depend on him every day. So he just provided it on a daily basis to test them to see if they would obey. And it'll come about on the sixth day when they prepare it, they bring it in, it'll be twice as much as they gather daily. That's to cover Sunday. So Moses and Aaron said to all the sons of Israel, "At evening you will know that the Lord has brought you out of the land of Egypt, and in the morning you will see the glory of the Lord, for he hears your grumblings against the Lord. And what are we that you grumble against us?" And so he provided for them then this manna. In verse 15, it's called, "What is it?" That's what manna means. They look at it, it's laying out there on the ground, and they say, "What is that?" That's what manna means. And so he provided them some, "What is it?" that they could cook and eat. So they grumbled again on their way down. Then in chapter 17 in the book of Exodus, we see the same thing, first seven verses. "All the congregation of sons of Israel journeyed by stages from the wilderness of Sin, according to the command of the Lord, and camped at Rephidim, and there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore the people quarreled with Moses and said, 'Give us water that we may drink.' And Moses said to them, 'Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?' And the people thirsted there for water, and they grumbled against Moses and said, 'Why now have you brought us from Egypt to kill us and with our children and our livestock with thirst?'" How long would you like to hear this grumbling and complaining day in and day out if you were Moses? This would get old in a hurry, wouldn't it? So Moses cried out to the Lord saying, "What shall I do to this people? and a little more and they'll stone me. And the Lord said to Moses, pass before the people, take with you some of the elders of Israel, take your hand in your staff, take your staff in your hand with which you struck the Nile, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it that the people may drink. And he did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. And they named the place Massah and Meribah because of the quarrel of the sons of Israel, and because they tested the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? Well, this seems like a little bit of a rocky start, doesn't it? I mean, they've come out of Egypt by God's grace. He has led them with the mechanisms that he's talked about before. He led them through the Red Sea miraculously. They're working their way down the Sinai Peninsula toward Mount Sinai, and he's provided water for them. He's provided food for them. And in return, from all of that, he gets an earful of grumbling and complaining. This doesn't look like it's going to be a real wonderful time, does it? And then in verses 8 through 16, we have the incident involving Amalek and God's saving his people from their enemies as well. So the lessons learned on their way down to Sinai is that God will, if they will obey God, he will lead them, he will provide for them, and he will defend them from their enemies. So they've been taught all of that stuff just getting down to here. That took about 3 months to get down there. So in the first 3 months of their redeemed history, they see God leading them, providing for them, taking care of them, defending them against their enemies. All of that in the first several months of their walk before God. Then they finally get down there to Mount Sinai, located down here in South Central Sinai Peninsula. And they're going to stay there for about a little short of a year, about 11 months. So 3 months to get down there, and they're going to spend about a year there, a little less. And while they're there, they're taught some things as well. He teaches them, while camped there at Sinai, what the conditions for his blessings on them as a redeemed people are. In Exodus chapter 19, verses 4 through 8, he says this, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now then, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. You shall be to me as a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the sons of Israel. So Moses came and called the elders of the people, said before them all these words which the Lord had commanded him. And the people answered together and said, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do. And Moses brought back the words of the people to the Lord. So while they're camped there, God enters into this deal with the people. He says, I'm going to propose a covenant with you guys. And the covenant says that if you'll obey my voice and do what I say, then you shall be to me a nation of priests and interface between me and mankind in a unique and marvelous role. And they heard the deal and they said, we'll take it. We like that deal. We want that. Let's do that. So their response was, we'll take the deal. Now, that deal is known as the Mosaic Covenant. Was it a conditional or an unconditional covenant? What's the first word God said when he proposed the covenant to them? That's conditional, isn't it? If you will do this, then I will do that. So the Mosaic Covenant is a conditional covenant. You must obey first to get the blessings that follow. What later on became the sign of belief in that conditional covenant? What's the sign of belief in the Mosaic Covenant? Keeping the Sabbath. What's the sign of belief in the Abrahamic covenant, which had preceded this one? Circumcision. Yeah. So those acts on the part of the Jewish people are indications of their belief in these covenants. We'll see this one come about later. So while camped down there at Sinai, about 3 months after coming out of Egyptian bondage, God enters into them with a covenant known as the Mosaic Covenant. And that covenant set forth the laws of how they were to behave in their relationship to God that would please him. And it included the famous Ten Commandments, laws about slavery, personal injury, theft, property damage, dishonesty, immorality, civil and religious obligations, Sabbaths and feasts that they were to keep, and conquests. All of that information was included in the information given initially at Mount Sinai by God in the form of this new covenant. And the modus operandi set up between God and them, as he stated earlier, was, if you will obey me, then I will bless you. If you disobey me, I will judge you. So the conditions are, and the way that that relationship between them worked, you have to obey to get the blessings. Is that the modus operandi of the church today? Do we operate on the basis of law? Do this, do that, all that kind of stuff? No, of course not. Today it's grace. We live by faith under the principle of God's grace, not the law. Paul talks about that ad infinitum in various places, Romans and Galatians in particular. So, but back then, the condition between them and him was a legal set of do's and don'ts that they must follow. And they heard all of that, and in Exodus chapter 24, verse 3, they said, where do we sign? Moses came and recounted to the people all the words of the Lord and all the ordinances, and the people answered with one voice and said, all the words which the Lord has spoken, we will do. We will obey this covenant and be your obedient people, and you can use us then in that unique role that you offered up earlier there in chapter 19. They ratified this covenant. So after getting this set of laws to live by, that kind of was like their constitution or so on, God established a system of worship whereby they might worship him as their God. And it basically boiled down to something like this. They ended up with this tabernacle that was designed to reflect various characteristics of the Lord, of Jesus Christ. All that stuff, all the furnishings, all the furniture, and all that reflects him in some way. And God was going to come and dwell with them in their midst then in this tabernacle. So he gave them all the instructions for how to set up this system of worship. And it ended up being a tent surrounded by a wall and various pieces of furniture for different things. You remember that. We've been through that before, I'm sure. That tent area looked like this in terms of a schematic. There were pieces of furniture set inside that tent. The Ark of the Covenant was back here, and this is where God's presence was symbolized to them right there. And there's other pieces of furniture around. You can see all that stuff there. We don't have to go through all that detail again, but basically he established for them then this system of worship. How does a redeemed people worship their God? And he gave them the system to do that. That's what that was all about. And the structure, the furniture, and then he actually even developed in a priesthood within this religious system to be the mediators in between him and the rest of the nation. And they would be the guys that you would come to and work through them then if you wanted to approach God. And clearly with all of that, things had to be going very well, doesn't it? I mean, who could not be a happy camper with all of that information given to them and so on? Well, they couldn't be. In verse chapter 32, remember what happened? When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people assembled around Aaron and said, come, make us a God who will go before us. As for this Moses character, the man who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we don't know what has become of him. He must have died up there on the mountain. So Aaron, you take over and you lead us and be our guy. And so what does Aaron tell him? Here's some wonderful leadership on his part, verse 2. Aaron said to him, well, tear off the gold rings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me. I imagine that went over real well when the guys started ripping the earrings off of their wives to collect this gold. Then all the people tore off the gold rings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron, and he took this from their hands, and he fashioned it with a graving tool and made it into a molten calf. Ooh, I think one of the first of the Ten Commandments might take issue with this. Making a golden calf.
No other gods.
What's that?
No other gods.
Yeah, that's exactly right. First commandment they violate in a matter of months. So he made it into a molten calf, and they said, "This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt." And when Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made a proclamation and said, "Tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord." So the next day they rose early and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and drink, and they rose up to play. And the Lord spoke to Moses up on the mountain there. He says, "Go down at once, for your people from whom you brought up from the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves." God kind of disassociates himself from the people here at this time, doesn't he? They have quickly turned aside from the day which I commanded them. They've made for themselves a molten calf and worshipped it and have sacrificed to it. And he said, "This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt." And the Lord said to Moses, "I have seen this people, and behold, they are an obstinate people. Now let me alone. Get away from me, Moses, that my anger may burn against them, that I may destroy them, and I will make you a great nation." So in just a little bit of time after being given the basics of the Mosaic Covenant, the people violated it and slipped right back into idolatry again already under the leadership of Aaron. And God said, "I'm going to just wipe these people out. And we'll start over again, Moses, with you being sort of the new Abraham. We'll start here, build a new nation, and go on from here. We'll just wipe these guys out. They're not worth fooling with. This 2 million is just a waste of my time. And so we're going to get rid of them." And if Moses hadn't intervened on their behalf, I guess they would have been wiped out. It's only Moses' intervention that follows that kept God from wiping them out. The nation literally owes Moses their existence. If he just said, "Hey, I kind of like the sound of that plan you got there, God. Let's do that. Let's wipe these people out, and we'll start over with me and my family, and we'll build a new nation. I like that thinking." That's, if he had done that, they'd been toast. They owe their existence here to this guy Moses. He steps forward. Aaron's out there leading them into corruption, and Moses steps forward and leads them into forgiveness, and does. And so in Exodus chapter 34, they renew the covenant. God forgives them. They write it down on a second set of tablets, and things are sort of salvaged at the last little bit. Then they build that tabernacle and everything that they had instructions with. In Exodus chapter 40, that tabernacle is built, and God joins them as a people. Verses 34 through the end of Exodus 40. "Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And Moses was not able to enter the tent of the meeting because the cloud had settled on it. And the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And throughout all their journeys, whenever the cloud was taken up from the tabernacle, the sons of Israel would set out. But if the cloud was not taken up, then they did not set out until the day when it was. For throughout all their journeys, the cloud of the Lord was on the tabernacle by day, and there was a fire in it by night, and the sight of all the house of Israel." So what's happened now is that after the restoration of the covenant, God has, in essence, entered into, I don't know, I just turned that thing, moved that thing all over the place there, didn't I? God has entered into that tent area here, and his presence was noted and seen by either this cloud or by a pillar of fire. And so after this major mess up with Aaron, the covenant has been re-ratified, and Emmanuel has taken place. God is with us. He entered into that tabernacle, and he lived there with them then for some time. And then God established next the way of approach to him while in there, and that was a sacrificial system that we see there in the book of Leviticus. You could not approach God under the Mosaic Covenant without a sacrifice of some kind. That was the only way God could be approached, is through sacrifices. And so in Leviticus, you have the big five up front, and then you have a bunch of other stuff later on, but he established that system for them as well. So those priests were intermediaries between him and the rest of the nation only through a system of sacrifices, and all of that they learned and were taught while down at Mount Sinai during that year. Mount Sinai is not the promised land. That's not where they were supposed to end up at. They're just on their way, so they're not there yet. But while down here, he establishes then this Mosaic Covenant, the system of worship, and all that during this year down here. The ultimate goal is to get up here, the promised land. Why didn't he just bring them across here? Well, the scriptures tell us because they weren't ready yet for war. They weren't prepared yet to deal with the enemies they were going to encounter, and so God is taking them around about. And now, after being down here for a year, they're going to go up and start considering moving into the Promised Land from the south. They're going to head up to a place called Kadesh Barnea, which is up here. And so the plan was to come up here, kind of check things out here, and then go on in and start taking the land from the south upward. So after that year or so they spent down there, they're going to be on the move again. In Numbers, we see that activity going on in their history. Now, if I can get my pages to stop sticking together so badly, we'll look at some of this. In Numbers chapter 9, they kind of turn the brake off and get ready to move again. Numbers chapter 9, verses 15 through 19. Now on the day that the tabernacle was erected, the cloud covered the tabernacle, the tent of the testimony, and in evening it was like the appearance of fire over the tabernacle until morning. So it was continuously the cloud would cover it by day and the appearance of fire by night. And whenever the cloud was lifted, they would move. And when it wasn't lifted, they would stay put. And that was kind of the general pattern now for movement. And in chapter 10, verse 11-ish, it came about in the second year, on the second month, on the 20th of the month, that the cloud was lifted up from the tabernacle of the testimony, and the sons of Israel set out on their journey from the wilderness of Sinai. So about a year and 3 months, year and 2 months later from the Exodus, it's time now to get moving on up toward Kadesh Barnea. So that's what those passages are telling us. They're moving now. They're on their way from Sinai up to Kadesh Barnea. So they're rolling along, heading up there, and I'm sure things will be a lot better than they were coming down to there, don't you? Aren't you sure they'd be different? Numbers chapter 11, now the people became like those who complain of adversity in the hearing of the Lord, and when the Lord heard it, his anger was kindled, and the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some of them on the outskirts of the camp. Yikes! God is getting now so fed up with their murmuring that he's starting to punish them. He's slaying some of them. The people therefore cried out to Moses, and Moses prayed to the Lord, and the fire died out. Apparently he was consuming them by fire around the edges of the camp. And so they named that place Taberah, because the fire of the Lord burned among them. Well, that doesn't sound like that's going all that great, does it? So they worked their way on up toward Kadesh Barnea. That took about another 11 months or so to move up through there. And so they finally get up there. And in Numbers chapter 13, we see what happens when they got up there. Moses decided he would go in and spy out the land. You remember that story? So he sends some people in there, somebody from every tribe, to go in and spy out the land up there and come back and report on what they found. So they do that. In chapter 13, about verse 26 and following, we get the report. They proceeded to come to, and by the way, look at verse 25. They returned from spying out the land at the end of 40 days. They spent 40 days spying out the land, these representatives, one from each tribe. 40 days. Remember that number, 40. So they go and do that. In verse 26, they proceeded to come to Moses and Aaron and tell all the congregation of the sons of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. And they brought back word to them and to all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. Thus they told him, and they said, well, we went into the land where you sent us, and it certainly does flow with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. Nevertheless, the people who live in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large. And moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. Amalek is living in the land of the Negev, and the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites are living in the hill country, and the Canaanites are living by the sea and by the side of the Jordan. In other words, they come back and say, we scouted this place out real well, and man, there's some bad dudes living there. This is not going to be a cakewalk. There's some meanies there. Then Caleb, who was one of the 12, who spied, quieted the people before Moses and said, we should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we shall surely overcome it. Caleb says, we can do it. But the men who had gone up with him said, we're not able to go up against the people, for they're too strong for us. So the majority viewpoint was, we can't take this land that you promised to give us, God. the people there are too strong. And Caleb is trying to beat that back and say, yeah, we can. So they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, the land through which we have gone in spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it are men of great size. There also we saw the Nephilim. The sons of Anak are part of the Nephilim, and we became like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight. So the report was a very negative one. The report said, no, we can't take this land. The people in it are too strong for us. So that ain't going to work. So God in verse 14 was not happy with that attitude. In verses 26, he says, the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, how long shall I bear with this evil congregation who are grumbling against me? I've heard the complaints of the sons of Israel which they are making against me. Say to them, as I live, says the Lord, just as you have spoken in my hearing, so I will surely do to you. Your corpses shall fall in the wilderness, even all your numbered men, according to complete number from 20 years old and upwards, who have grumbled against me. Everybody 20 years old and older in the nation is going to die off before God is going to do anything for them because of this report that they came back with and basically denied God's ability to give them the land that He promised them. He says, surely you shall not come into the land in which I swore to you, except Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, the son of Nun. Your children, however, whom you said would become prey, I will bring them in, and they shall know the land which you have rejected. But as for you, your corpses shall fall in this wilderness. Verse 36, and as for the men whom Moses sent to spy out the land, who entered and made all the congregation grumble against him by bringing out a bad report concerning the land, even those men who brought out the very bad report in the land died by a plague before the Lord. So the 10 out of the 12 guys God slew by a plague, and He told the entire congregation that everybody 20 years old and older will wander around and die off and will not be taken into the promised land because of their distrust and their disbelief in what He had promised to do for them. And so they wandered around for the next 40 years, 38 perhaps, 40 may be counted from the Exodus, 1 year for every day that they were in there spying out the land. Every day that they spent, the 40 days, He punished them by taking making them wander for a year for that. It took them the 40 years for that nation to die off. And unfortunately, in Numbers chapter 20, we have Moses' sin, where his role as God's theocratic administrator is essentially forfeited. God has been leading this people through Moses up to this point in time. Moses disobeys God in Numbers chapter 20. He smites a rock when God told him to speak to the rock, and God judges him because of that, and Moses then loses his privilege of the role of God's theocratic administrator, and Moses never got to enter the promised land. After being led by God through all this, he forfeited that through his disobedience. And in Numbers chapter 27, Joshua comes on the scene and he becomes the new theocratic administrator. Verses 12 and following, we won't read down through all that. Basically, it's just the fact that now Joshua is introduced in essence to the nation as the new leader to replace Moses, and does so. And so he then brings the people up and around and gets ready to enter the land over here. And Moses has to stand on the east side of the Jordan and just look over and see the promised land. He can't ever go in it. So Joshua now, at this point in time, has become the new theocratic administrator and the new leader of the nation under God. And just before entering in, we have the book of Deuteronomy and its role in their history. What does Deuteronomy mean? Deutero means two, or second. Anonymy means the law. It's the second giving of the law. Why is there a second giving of the law needed as these people are about to enter the promised land? Can they not remember the first giving of the law? They're dead. Their memories has faded badly. When they're dead, they don't remember anything, remember? They wandered around and died off 20 years and older. Now you have people that are 60 and under, ready to enter the land. They haven't heard the Mosaic law very clearly. So Moses repeats it to this new generation that is about to enter the promised land up there. Second law, Deuteronomy, is what that's all about. So, under the leadership of Joshua now, they do actually enter into the land. Moses dies off, and Joshua becomes the new leader. And they allocated the land based upon the tribal sizes and so on. And it looks like this. This is how the 12 tribes would divvy up the promised land under the leadership of Joshua. You can see where the tribes are and all that kind of stuff. Some of them stayed on the east side. Most of them came on over into the west. And so came about after the death of Moses, a servant of the Lord, that the Lord spoke to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' servant, saying, I'm reading Joshua chapter 1 now. Moses, my servant, is dead. Now, therefore, arise, cross this Jordan, you and all this people, into the land which I am giving to them, the sons of Israel. Every place in which the sole of your foot treads, I have given to you, just as I spoke to Moses. From the wilderness of Lebanon, it gives a bunch of dimensions and so on here. Jump down to verse 6. Be strong and courageous, for if you shall give this people possession of the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. Verse 7. Only be strong and very courageous. Be careful to do according to all the law which Moses my servant commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right or left, that you may have success wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do according to all that is written in it. And then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have success. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Third time they're told that as they're about to enter the promised land. Don't tremble, don't be dismayed. The Lord your God is with you wherever you go. So they're now ready to enter the promised land, and this might be kind of a high point in their history. As they enter the land that God has promised them to take it over and to dwell there as He told them to do. You think things went okay? Well, unfortunately, they didn't go as well as one would hope. Chapter 15, verse 63. Now, for the Jebusites, the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the sons of Judah, could not drive them out. So the Jebusites have lived with the sons of Judah at Jerusalem until this day. And that doesn't sound like they were completely successful there, does it? Judah wasn't completely successful. Who finally cleared them Jebusites out of Jerusalem? David. We'll see that later. But these guys didn't take them out. They're around there another several hundred years. That doesn't sound like very good success, does it? Look at 16:10. But they did not drive out the Canaanites who lived in Gezer. So the Canaanites live in the midst of Ephraim to this day, and they became forced laborers. So they didn't drive them out either. In 17:12, the sons of Manasseh could not take possession of these cities because the Canaanites persisted in living in that land. And it came about when the sons of Israel became strong, they put the Canaanites to forced labor, but they did not drive them out completely. So this picture now is not coming together as well as one would hope. They're taking some of the land over, but not all of it. The successes are just partial. It'll even get worse, and your analogy will be even more accurate in just a little bit. We'll see that as we go along in just a moment. So under the leadership of Joshua, they had partial successes, but not total. And in Joshua chapter 24, came about after these things that Joshua the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died, being 110 years old. And they buried him in the territory of his inheritance in this place. And Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who survived Joshua, and had known all the deeds of the Lord which he had done for Israel. So for the 25 years that Joshua ruled and led the nation, they were successful to some degree at least. And then Joshua died off. What happened after that? What were the conditions in the nation following Joshua's death? Did they get in there and take over that land like God had told them to do? And who's the new theocratic administrator? If it was Moses and he's died, and then Joshua, and if it was Joshua now he's died, who has taken over after him? Who is God going to work through to lead his people in the form of a theocratic administrator since Joshua has died off? What were the conditions following Joshua's death? Judges chapter 1. came about after the death of Joshua that the sons of Israel inquired of the Lord, well, who shall go up first against us, against the Canaanites? And the Lord said, Judah shall go up. I've given this land to him. And so Judah got Simeon to go up with him, and they went up in verse 4 and started trying to take the land again. How did it work out? Verse 21. Well, let's pick up in 19. The Lord was with Judah, and they took possession of the hill country, but they could not drive out the inhabitants of the valley because they had iron chariots. Verse 21, the sons of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who lived in Jerusalem. Verse 22, likewise, when Joseph went up, they weren't able to take all their land either. Verse 27, Manasseh did not take possession of Beth Shean and its villages. Verse 29, neither did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites. Verse 30, Zebulun did not drive out the inhabitants of Kitron. Verse 31, Asher did not drive out the inhabitants of Aco. 33, Naphtali did not drive out the inhabitants of that place. Verse 34, the Amorites forced the sons of Dan into the hill country. They ran Dan off. That doesn't sound like things are going too well. Partial success at best, and getting whipped and ran off at worst. So the political and military condition of the time was not all that great. Well, how about the spiritual condition? Was it any better? Chapter 2 of Judges. The angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim, and he said, I have brought you up from Egypt and led you into the land which I have sworn to your fathers. And I said, I will never break my covenant with you. As for you, you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You shall tear down their altars, but you have not obeyed me. What is this that you have done? Therefore, I also said, I will drive out them before you. Excuse me, I will not drive them out before you, but they shall become as thorns in your side, and their gods shall be a snare to you. And came about when the angel of the Lord spoke to the words, all these words to the sons of Israel, that they lifted up their voices and wept. So they named that place Bochim, and there they sacrificed to the Lord. Verse 10, and all that generation were gathered to their fathers, and there arose a generation after them who did not know the Lord, nor yet the work which he had done for Israel. Verse 11, so then the sons of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. After Joshua's death, things go south in a hurry. People are now resorting back to idolatry. They forsook the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt, and followed them from, and followed their gods from among the gods of the peoples that were around them, and bowed themselves down to them. Thus they provoked the Lord to anger, and they forsook the Lord, and served the Baal and the Ashtaroth. And the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and he gave them into the hands of plunderers who plundered them, and he sold them into the hands of their enemies around them, so that they could no longer stand before their enemies. Man, you talk about a deteriorating situation. All of a sudden, this ain't happening. They're disobeying God, resorting back to worshiping the idols of the pagan people that are living there that they're supposed to be running out. And God is giving them over then to these pagan peoples. And thus enters the era of the judges. You remember what happened there? We were here not too long ago. Over and over again, from here forward, for the next 330 years, a cycle is repeated that you see summarized right up there on that chart. They disobey God. He allows the pagan peoples around about them to oppress them for some period of time. The people cry out to God for help, and God raises up then a deliverer to help them under their distressful circumstances. These deliverers were known as judges. And there's a number of them, as you can see, listed there. And this cycle repeats itself over and over again through these different guys and gals. One of them's a gal. Here are your judges by name. Here are the number of years that they actually were operating and God was using them to deliver his people. And you go all the way from Othniel down here to Samson, the last one that's on this chart. And every one of these cycles is the same. Every time they disobey God, they start out by disobeying God. He allows their enemies to oppress them. They cry out. He mercifully sends a leader to deliver them, and they get back into a pretty good stead again. And that goes along for a while, and they turn right back to disobeying God again. And there it goes again, over and over and over again, for 330 years. That same cycle repeats itself. And as you get down toward the latter part of it, the nation is just really in rough shape, probably the worst in their history. This chart just shows where the judges kind of worked and operated. As you can see, they're pretty well scattered kind of fairly evenly throughout the whole country. In other words, all the tribes needed somebody. They all had problems. They all needed help from time to time. And God sent these judges and kind of covered it from the north to the south of the whole land there. So what's the general condition of things now at this particular point in time as we've reached the end of this period of the judges? A very good guess. So for this 330 years, the theocratic administrator is going to be one of these judges. That's who God is going to work through to help and lead his people. Moses, Joshua, 12 judges, and them from different times. In Judges chapter 17, we get kind of a taste of what the moral condition in the nation is at this point in time. You can see in the home, first six verses, chapter 17 is where this guy steals some idols, some silver from his mother. Remember that story when we were there not too long ago? He steals this stuff from his mother. When he then fesses up later on, she's so happy and glad that he returned it that she makes an idol out of it, actually to him, and sets them up to worship the idol. The home life stinks at this particular time. In the latter chapters here, we see in chapter 19 and thereabouts that homosexuality has settled into the city of Gibeah. Remember that incident where this guy takes his concubine up there and the whole city wants the men, her husband, to come out so that they can have relationships with him, and it's just like Sodom all over again. He doesn't do that, but he leaves his concubine out, and they rape her to death overnight. He takes her and cuts her into pieces and sends a piece to all the different tribes of Israel and say, hey, this is what we've become. Let's take vengeance on the tribe that did this, and that was Benjamin. The city of Gibeah is in Benjamin's territory. And so the morality of the people stinks at this point in time. The priesthood is in shambles. Remember the story about this guy who just went around selling himself to anybody that would buy him as their priest and use him as their priest, give him a suit of clothes and a place to live and that sort of thing? They weren't serving the Lord. They were serving themselves. So the home life is a mess. The morality of the nation is a mess. The priesthood is a total mess. And in Judges chapter 18, Dan, the tribe of Dan, actually reinstitutes idolatry and the practice of that into the nation. And civil war breaks out between the different tribes over the killing of this concubine, and they nearly wiped out the tribe of Benjamin. Remember, they got down to 600 guys, and there weren't enough women left for them? So they go over and they wipe out this place and take their women so they can provide these guys with some women so they can continue that tribe. What a total, absolute train wreck the nation has become in the 400 years following the Exodus when you get to the end of the period of the judges. It is a disaster. So what's the bottom line of all of this history from the Exodus down to where we are here now, this 400-year look? Well, God redeemed his people from Egyptian bondage via the Passover and what it represented. He promised them very soon thereafter he would lead them, provide for them, defend them. He gave them a law to live by that would enable them to please him in their conduct and behavior before them. He gave them a system to worship him by. He established the operating principle between him and them that if they would obey him, he would bless them. And if they disobeyed, he would punish them. And yet, in spite of all of that, spiritual and moral decay has just totally consumed the place. And only through the period of the judges was the nation sort of saved or preserved by the judges, God working through the judges, or they probably would have been destroyed in that time frame. So they're definitely at a low point in their history. So what is God going to do? Who's the next theocratic administrator going to be? Who is he going to work through next to try to kind of sweep up the pieces that we find at the end of the period of the judges and get this nation back on its feet again? Samuel. That's what we're going to go study. We're going to see that answer. We're going to find out, who does God use? What does He do now at this low point in their history to sort of regroup them and get them going again? And who is He going to provide as a new theocratic administrator to this people? You can probably guess ahead of time that since the study is on the life of David, that maybe it has something to do with David. That would be a good guess on your part. But he isn't the first theocratic administrator on the scene. He's the third. We got to get some other people in place before. Do you understand the setting here? You see the history and where they are as a nation. They're about as low as you can get, spiritually, morally, and every other way. And God is going to have to, in essence, redeem them again. Not really redeem them, but He's going to have to patch them up. He's going to have to help them and rebuild the nation from this low state that they're currently in. And that's where David comes in. It's where Samuel comes in. It's where Saul comes in. It's where David comes in. It's where Solomon comes in. We'll see those guys and what God does to sort of correct this miserable situation that we see here at the end of the Judges. I actually thought we'd get into 1 Samuel this morning. This history takes too long. We'll get into it next week. Any questions or comments about the setting? It's a depressing storyline, isn't it? This 400 years went from good to bad to worse. And this period of Judges illustrates that as well as anything, doesn't it? All those different cycles, the same thing. And remember, he told Moses, I'm going to wipe these people out. He said, I am not putting up with this any further. And only by Moses' intervention did they not get wiped out then. And so you wonder, well, why did he put up with all of these cycles? 12 different judges, major judges, there may be three or four minor ones, but 12 major judges over 330 years, and he's still putting up with it. Very, very patient. Very long-suffering toward us sinners, isn't he? Okay, we'll get into David's life. Actually, start with Samuel next time. Start working our way toward David. And we'll just kind of remind ourselves from time to time of this rather dismal setting that the nation is in at this time. Any questions or comments?
When you said who comes next, I thought for sure you were going to say Trump.
I'll read a little closer. I didn't see his name in there, but it may be in there. I'll dig out that next time then for you. Okay, we will let you roll and see you next Sunday, Lord willing. Have a good week.